Everyone ready? A couple of people not ready, just coming in. Okay, so let's start. And we are looking at the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So just to remind those of you who have been here before, this, I think this is session number 8 or something on the sutta. So just to give a reminder in case you haven't been here, that this is about the Buddha's last journey as he's traveling from Rajagaha, the capital of the Magadhan Empire, and is traveling to his destination where eventually he will pass away, which is Kushinara, quite a long distance away from Rajagaha. So he's on this long journey, and as he's traveling on this journey, all these events happen. And all of these events are actually quite interesting, because this is when the Buddha knows that he's close to passing away, and he kind of, his purpose is to pass on vital information, if you like, to the Sangha, to the lay people, about what Buddhism is really about, the message that should be carried on into the future, and all of these kind of things. So it's a very interesting sutta for these reasons. And also quite a lot of historical data in here, which we have discussed at least to some extent before. So now the Buddha has arrived at Vesali, and there he goes to stay in Ambapali, Ambapali's grove. Ambapali, she was a courtesan, she was very, very wealthy and very beautiful and all of these kind of things. And she was living in Vesali, and she had a mango grove. So obviously she must have been quite wealthy if you have your own mango grove. The Buddha used to stay there when he came to Vesali. And of course, one of the things that what's going to happen next is this meeting between Ambapali and the Buddha. And so the Buddha, one of the first things he does is to kind of tell his monks to be aware, to be careful. Yeah, there's a kind of a, you know, this famous courtesan is coming. So you have to be mindful and fully aware. This is what this is about. And this is what the Buddha is going to talk about next. So that kind of watch your senses and this kind of stuff is what this is about. So let's come back to what's happening next. This is what's happening here. So paragraph 211, just to recap a little bit. And when the Lord had stayed at Nadika as long as he wished, etc., etc., he went with a large company of monks to Vesali, where he stayed at Ambapali's grove. I should point out that Vesali was one of the great cities of India at that time, with the capital city of the Vajjian kingdom, it was a Vajjian confederacy, it was actually more like a democratic republic, and this was the main city, and the Buddha had several monasteries around Vesali. One of the famous monasteries was the Kutagara Sala, which means the house with the peaked roof, and he stayed there for many rains retreats. And he had a lot of support, obviously, in Vesali. If you go to India today, you go to Vesali, there's nothing left. There's just kind of fields and rubbish and a few ancient stupas and that kind of thing. But basically, it's very hard to imagine what it may have looked like 2,500 years ago. So he goes to Vesali and he stays in Ambapali's grove, this famous courtesan. And then he says, and there the Lord addressed the monks. Monks, a monk should be mindful and clearly aware. This is our charge, or this is our instruction, probably be slightly better. This is our instruction to you. So here we have these two words, mindful, sati in Pali, clearly aware, sampajana or sampajanya. So these two kind of very important words that we find in the suttas again and again. Sati, of course, being part of the Noble Eightfold Path. Mindfulness, sati. And sampajanya being a word that you find also throughout the suttas. And this idea here called clearly aware can also be translated as clearly comprehending or fully aware. Sampajanya is a word which has the root meaning of the word. It's panya, sampajanya. Panya is actually part of that word. It may not sound quite like it's there, but actually it is. And panya, of course, is the wisdom aspect. And because the wisdom aspect is important to sampajanya, that's why some people call it clearly comprehending. In other words, comprehension is the wisdom aspect there. Yeah, so clear comprehension, full awareness, I think, is also finer. It kind of has a roughly the same idea. So now the Buddha is going to talk about sati and sampajanya. And one of the interesting things about the way the Buddha talks about it here is that he divides it up. He says sati is one thing, sampajanya is something else. Yeah, and sati, as you might expect, is the four satipatthanas. Yeah, the four sometimes called foundations of mindfulness, or I would prefer to call it the four applications of mindfulness, areas where you focus, areas that you are aware of. And sampajanya here is actually something different from that. And that is very interesting here, because one of the things that you, those of you who have studied the suttas for quite a while will realize is that this particular way that sampajanya is defined here is actually included within Satipatthana in the Satipatthana Sutta. If you read the Satipatthana Sutta, this paragraph that's coming up next year, or the not the very next one, but the one afterwards, is actually in the Satipatthana Sutta. So how can it be in the Satipatthana Sutta if it is different from Satipatthana? Here the Buddha says there are different things. In the Satipatthana Sutta, he says one is included within the other. So which one is correct? And to understand that, this is where you have to understand some of the kind of textual history, if you like, of the suttas, and to see how they have kind of emerged into what they are now over hundreds or even thousands of years. And this is where studies like Ajahn Sujata did a very interesting study on the Satipatthana Sutta. Others have also done similar studies, where he shows that the Satipatthana Sutta is not actually what we have now is very unlikely to be the original version of the sutta. The sutta has been expanded over time. How do we know these things? And it always comes back to the same thing: textual comparison, comparing the different lineages of the suttas. And what you find is that the Pali version of the sutta is quite different from some of the other versions. And his conclusion after doing a long study, you've got to be really interested in the suttas to read his study. I have to warn you, it really goes into a lot of detail. But if you're really, really keen on suttas, you can try to read his study called The History of Mindfulness. It's available online for free download, so very easy to get hold of. But his conclusion at the end of all that is that things like the clear comprehension here is a later addition to the Satipatthana Sutta. It doesn't actually belong there. It's actually a separate practice that should be separated from Satipatthana. Yeah, this is one of the conclusions that he comes to in this study. And it's very interesting. Once you start to sometimes look at these things, things tend to fall in place a little bit, because otherwise it doesn't make any sense that it's both separate and included. Or maybe it is, maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't make sense that it's both separate and included. Maybe things are just complicated. Sometimes it's very difficult to be absolutely sure. But I think that his study is a good one and quite reliable in that respect. So this is just a little bit by way of background so that you can understand what is happening next year and how these things actually, how this kind of fits together. So, the Buddha says, be mindful and clearly aware. And the context here being Ambapali is soon to arrive. Yeah? So this is kind of the reason we have this, especially clear awareness. And how is a monk mindful? How is a nun? How is anyone mindful? Here a monk abides contemplating the body as body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, having put away hankering and fretting for the world. And likewise with regard to feelings, mind and mind objects. This is how a monk is mindful. I don't know what you think about that. What do you think about hankering and fretting? Is that a word that you use often in daily conversations? Is that kind of what you say to your friends? Oh, hankering a lot today. I don't know, I think what Maurice Walsh maybe kind of trying to find different words for different contexts. Okay, hankering. Okay, we'll chuck hankering in there. Sounds good. But to me, hankering and fretting, I must admit, when I first read that, I wondered, what on earth is this? This is really, sounds really strange to me. And I think this is one of the reasons why Ajahn Brahm likes to, you know, when he does his word of the Buddha, he kind of translates things afresh. Because sometimes when you see things from different angles, you kind of see what things actually mean. But anyway, let's have a look at this, because it is perhaps not quite as obvious as it may seem. So a monk abides contemplating, or anyone abides contemplating, the body as a body, kaya kaya nupassi in Pali. Kaya can mean a number of things. It can certainly refer to the physical body. So what does it mean to contemplate the body as a body? And I'm going to go through this, not in too much detail, because it will take too long, but just to remind you all of these things, because these are kind of core things in the Dhamma. This is a Madhyasatipatthana practice, absolutely core for meditation. So it's good to be reminded of what's going on here. And the way I understand this, basically what it means, it is about contemplating a certain aspect of the body. Yeah, you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, it gives you various ways, a certain way of contemplating the body. It gives you various ways of contemplating the body, the 31 parts. Not the 32 parts, by the way. I hope you are clear about that. It's 31, not 32 parts. It's not very important, but there's a distinction between how it is divided in the Visuddhimagga and in the suttas. Suttas have 31 parts. The Visuddhimagga has 32 parts. Visuddhimagga added the brain. The brain is not found in the suttas. So 31 parts of the body, four elements, contemplation. These are probably the core aspects, the core ways of contemplating the body. But then over time, you have things like the cemetery contemplation. The breath is mentioned in there, and all of these kind of things. So it's a certain way of contemplating the body, a certain aspect of the body, if you like, or a certain feature of the body that you're focusing on. So that is how I would translate that, to make it really transparent. A monk abides contemplating a certain feature or a certain aspect of the body. Perhaps that can be improved upon, but it gives a rough idea of what's going on. Then we have the word earnestly next. And the word behind that is atapi in Pali. And tapas is a bit like what the Indians used to do in those days, a bit like tormenting the body. Sometimes translated as ardent, this particular one. But ardent, to me, again, is a word which is, I think, a little bit too obscure to be clear what is going on. So what exactly does it refer to here? How it is defined elsewhere in the suttas, it's defined in exactly the same way as the four right efforts. The four right efforts being part of the Noble Eightfold Path, being part of such an important central part of so many aspects of the way of looking at Buddhist practice. And so it essentially is about right effort. But right effort in Buddhism can happen in a number of ways. There is the effort of exerting yourself. Sometimes you have to exert yourself a little bit. You have to come here to Dhammaloka Center to do your meditation practice. Or you have to try to think about things. How can I be wise about this? Think about things in a new way. There's always a little bit of exertion involved. Not too much, but at least a little bit. And then, on the other hand, as you practice deepens, there is like a natural exertion. This is called energy. This is virya in Pali. And virya is no longer the fact that you are exerting yourself, it's the natural energy of the mind. So when you look at, for example, the seven sattasambuddhanga, the seven factors of awakening, they start off with mindfulness, is what we're seeing here. Then you have which is the Sati Sambuddhanga. Then you have the Dhammavicaya Sambuddhanga, which is the factor of awakening, which is the contemplation of mental qualities. And then you have the Virya Sambuddhanga. And what we're seeing here is the process of samadhi is happening. The process of meditation is happening here. And there comes a point when your defilements are there's very few defilements left in the mind. And that is where the Virya arises, the natural energy here. You don't really have to exert yourself anymore. Your energy is your mind is naturally energetic. And this is the ideal energy. When you are just kind of bubbling with energy and you're kind of moving along in samadhi in this way. So these are the kind of two, if you like, extremes of energy. On the one hand, you have exerting yourself. On the other hand, you have the natural energy. And I think atapi here is somewhere slightly in between. It is slightly in between because we are doing the Satipatthana practice, yeah? So we haven't fully got to Samadhi yet. We're getting very close to Samadhi. Yeah? So it is, but it's not the full right efforts, which is the factor before Satipatthana. It is actually somewhere between Samadhi and the four right efforts. So there's a kind of subtle effort that is required to do the mindfulness of breathing and anything else, which is Satipatthana. So that is what is meant here, really. It is a kind of subtle effort, is what is meant. Earnestly, I think it misses the mark a little bit to me. Earnestly means like sincerely or something like that. But you have to be sincere, of course. But it has more to do with the kind of effort that you apply as you do this practice. And then we have clearly aware again, sampajano. So there it is, right there as part of Satipatthana practice as well. So when clearly aware is used by itself just below, then it has a specific meaning. But of course, you can also have this clear awareness, sampajanya. You can have it in many different aspects of the practice, not just when it stands on its own, but it can kind of also be applied to many different areas. So we also have to have full awareness or clear comprehension as part of contemplating the body as we're seeing here. So what does it mean to be clearly aware? What are we actually doing? Yeah, what is actually happening here? And the way that this is defined, it's not really defined in great detail in the suttas, but the way it is defined in the commentaries, and I think this is interesting and probably quite to the point, it makes good sense in the context, is clear awareness about purpose and suitability here. Yeah, so when you are, let's say you're watching the breath, yeah, and you are aware whether you are fulfilling the purpose of breath meditation. Am I actually fulfilling the purpose? Is what I'm doing now, is it suitable? Is it actually suitable to advance my meditation practice? Suitability and purpose. So if you sit there and you kind of your mind is kind of dull, or your mind is perhaps thinking, you forget about the breath, yeah? Suddenly the clear awareness kicks in and tells you, no, this is the wrong way. I'm not doing what I should be doing here. And so you gently guide your mind back to the breath again here. So you are aware of whether your practice is going right. Are you making progress? Is the breath becoming more subtle, more refined, more joyful, and all of these kind of things? And if it is, again, you know with clear awareness that you're heading in the right way. If not, then after the meditation you ask yourself, what was the problem? Was there a blockage there somewhere? And this is how you then make progress in your meditation practice, by reviewing it and understanding what the problems are here. So clear comprehension is about suitability and purpose. Am I fulfilling the purpose, which is the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path? And if I am, then you know that. If you're not, you know that. So it kind of gives you feedback, if you like, on your practice. So this is really clear awareness. And then it has mindful, yeah? So you have to be mindful to do Satipatthana practice. And this is a very important point. This is something you see also in the Satipatthana Anapanasati Sutta, which is the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing. Yeah. Core Meditation Sutta, yeah, Mindfulness of Breathing. How are we going to have success in Mindfulness of Breathing? Yeah. And one of the things you see there, when you read that sutta, and if you want to hear about that sutta in detail, come on my retreat. I always tend to go through Anapanasati Sutta in detail during my retreat. It's a really nice sutta, very beautiful, and very uplifting, full of joy and happiness and all these kind of things. But what it says in there is that you, first of all, you establish mindful, satting, parimukkang upatapetva, having established mindfulness in front of you. That's what it says, yeah? And here it says exactly the same thing again. You have to be mindful. Mindful here is an adjective which qualifies the practice of what you're doing here. So you have to be mindful to do mindfulness practice, to do Satipatthana. Mindfulness has to be there first. So both Satipatthana and Anapanasati are saying the same thing. And of course, if you know how the Anapanasati Sutta works, it specifically says by watching the breath, you are fulfilling all the four Satipatthanas. All you have to do is to watch the breath. And by doing that, you're actually completing a whole course in Satipatthana practice. So the two shouldn't, it makes sense that the guidelines should be the same for the two, because they're just two different ways of looking at exactly the same thing. Yeah? So you have to be mindful first. Yeah, and this is why it is so important when you do your meditation practice to kind of establish a degree of mindfulness before you even start watching the breath, before you even start to contemplate the four elements of the body or whatever it is that you like to do. Even metta practice, you can't really do metta properly without having mindfulness there. So establish mindfulness first, then the meditation becomes possible. If mindfulness isn't there, then you're not really going to, you can still do meditation practice, but it's not really going to be what the Buddha is talking about in the suttas. So notice that if you go to the breath too quickly, it won't really work, and it tends to be unpleasant because you have to use force. It tends not to really work out properly. So this is an important part here. Mindfulness has to be established first. So sometimes these little words in the suttas can be very meaningful once you know how to read them properly. And then we come to the famous one, having put away hankering and fretting for the world. What does that mean? Hankering, it means like desire. The Pali word is loke abhijja. Abhijja means just like desire. Yeah, sensual desire in particular is covered by that. Abhijja do manasa. Do manasa means literally bad mind. Do manasa. But in this context, it refers to kind of aversion to the sensual objects. How do we know that? Because you can compare it to the sense restraint formula, and there it specifically uses those words, abhijja domanasa. And of course, when it comes to sense restraint, it's precisely about not giving rise to desire and aversion in regard to the sensory objects that come through our senses, or that we perceive through our senses. So this is what it means here. It means having put aside, what is the word he means? Having put aside desire and aversion, yeah, for the world, loka. The meaning of world here, the word world in Pali, loka, is very similar to the idea of world in English. It's very broad in meaning. And one of the meanings in Pali is the kind of ordinary world that we inhabit. Yeah, the world of the five senses. It is said that when you practice the jhanas, for example, you have gone beyond the world. What is the world you have gone beyond? The world of the five senses. The ordinary sensory world is what you have gone beyond. And this is what it is referring to here. You have no more desire and aversion for that world of the five senses. This is another kind of a basic thing that is really required here before you can do Satipatthana practice properly. What does that mean in practice? It doesn't mean that you have to put away every smidgen of desire and aversion towards the world. And probably not, because part of Satipatthana Sutta is to help you abandon the very last parts of desire and aversion. Yeah, as part of that sutta. But it is a general putting away of any kind of strong desires and aversion that tend to pull your mind away from the present moment. There can still be some very subtle aspects of this left, but it's so subtle that it doesn't tend to distract you too much in watching the breath. And then you do the breath meditation, and as you do the breath meditation, the last remnants of desire and aversion are let go of by simply going through the breath meditation. So that is what that one means. So here you have the energy, yeah, or the effort. You have the clear awareness, the mindfulness. So you have a number of factors here that are somewhat similar to the five spiritual faculties. Not exactly, but there are some similarities to that, and that has sometimes been pointed out by, I think, the commentary defines these things in that way here. So that is the basic formula of Satipatthana practice. Very useful one. And then you have the same formula, and here Maurice Walsh, the translator, has really shortened things down to the absolute minimum, cut out all the repetitions, and just said, likewise, with regard to feelings, with regard to mind, and regard to mind objects. This is how a monk is mindful. So the feelings are just the Buddhist idea of feeling, vedana, which means just whether any experience is happy experience, unhappy, or if it is pleasing or displeasing or neutral. Mind is a state of the mind. So whatever state the mind is in, yeah. What is your mindset now? Are you feeling kind of are you feeling happy? Are you feeling kind of drowsy? Are you feeling have you got ill will? Have you kind of are you thinking about something completely different? Like I don't know what. This is a mind state. Yeah, desire, ill will, freedom from ill will. The large mind state that you have when you come to the samadhis, the mahagata citta. Literally means gone great, the mind gone great. Yeah, the mind which is expanded through your meditation practice. That's the mind state. And the last one here, mind objects, is a reference mostly to a causality and how the mind, how various qualities of mind are caused. Specifically the five hindrances, but also the seven factors of awakening. Why do these things exist? What causes these things? And once we understand the laws of causality that, you know, underlie desire, ill will, and all of these kind of things, once you understand those laws, you can remove the cause. You can also remove the problem. Or if you understand the cause of the seven factors of awakening, you can put the cause in there and then help these factors to arise. And the causes, once you know them, are very obvious. Yeah, why does desire arise? Because you're looking at an object in a way, looking for its attractiveness. And of course, the desire arises as a consequence. Anyway, I'm not going to go into all of that, because that would have to be for another time. So that is how a monk is mindful, or anyone else is mindful for that matter. So this is all about Satipatthana practice, how Satipatthana works out. And this then is the meditation practice part of things, and how to do your meditation. So, having looked at the meditation part of things, now we come to the clear awareness part of things, the full awareness or the clear comprehension. And so because we have just looked at what to do during meditation practice, the clear comprehension, as you will see in a second, is about what you do outside of meditation. Yeah, that is when clear comprehension comes in. Why is that? And the reason is because sati, as a very refined faculty, the kind of sati that you have when your mind becomes peaceful and you have a sharp awareness of what is going on, is almost impossible to have that during ordinary life. Yeah, your mind is going to be it's going to be too much movement in the mind, too many things happening, and because of that, we're not really able to keep that mindfulness. But what we can have, and this is what the Buddha is pointing out here, we can have sampajanya, clear awareness, clear comprehension, full awareness, and these kind of things. That is what that is about. So let's see what the Buddha has to say about this. So this is what he says. And how is a monk clearly aware? Here a monk, when going forward or backward, is aware of what he is doing. Okay, it is not a very good translation, to be honest. I feel anyway. This is sampajanakari. He is acting with full awareness, would be a much better way of putting it. Not just aware of what you're doing, you're acting with full awareness. Yeah, so you're acting with full awareness. It's close enough, perhaps, but anyway. So in looking forward and back, he is acting in full awareness. In bending and stretching, he is acting with full awareness. In carrying his inner and outer robe and bowl, he is acting in full awareness. In eating, drinking, chewing, and savoring, he is acting with full awareness. In passing excrement and urine, he is acting in full awareness. In walking, standing, sitting, and lying down. In keeping awake, in speaking, in staying silent, he is acting with full awareness. That is how a monk is acting with full awareness. So, these things that you see here, they are basically the sort of things that a monk or a nun does outside of the meditation practice. Don't think that this has no relevance to lay people. It does actually have relevance to everyone. It's just that the things that are listed would be slightly different, presumably, if you are a lay person. Yeah, when going to work, you act with full awareness. Yeah, when whatever it is, it would be kind of a different list there for lay people. Or if lay people who are not doing these things, then of course, then it would be much more similar. There are some lay people I know who live almost like monastics. Of course, then it would be quite similar to how we do things. So these things here refer typically to a monk's traditional life. Yeah, going forward and back. This refers to probably going on alms round. You can tell that from the vocabulary used. You can have a rough idea what is going on here. So you go forward into the village for alms, you come back again afterwards. Yeah, so this is kind of the typical thing that the monk would do when they're not doing meditation practice or studying the suttas or reciting something or whatever. Looking forward and back, you have to look out what is going on, especially you have to look out if somebody would like to offer you some alms. Bending or stretching the limbs is like putting out your bowl and that kind of stuff to receive alms food. Carrying your inner and outer robe and bowl. Yeah, it's fairly obvious. Eating, drinking, chewing and savoring. These are just different words for eating and drinking. Not sure why they have four words there, but you get the idea of what's going on. In passing excrement and urine. These are things that you do outside of meditation, obviously, here. In walking, standing, sitting, lying down, keeping awake, in speaking and staying silent. So all of these things are a reference to that. So what is... this is the... So this is then what you do outside of your meditation practice. You have clear awareness about your daily activities, yeah? And remember what I was saying before about the idea of clear awareness? The idea is of purpose and suitability here. So you can imagine if you are a monk, yeah, or a nun, and you go into town on alms round, there's different ways you can do that. Either you can kind of just be focused on what you're supposed to do. You're there to collect alms to sustain your life. Maybe if you get invited to a house, you give a little bit of a talk or do some chanting or whatever it is. Or you ask some questions or whatever. But that is your purpose. Your purpose is not to kind of go in and look around and think, well, these things are happening in the town and whatever it is, and kind of get all full of desires and excited about what is happening here. That is what the meaning of clear awareness there. You know the purpose and the suitability of what you're doing here. And so all of these things, same thing with talking. Why are you talking at a particular time? Yeah. Even why are you keeping silent? It's interesting. Keeping silent too, you have to do it with clear awareness. Are you doing it for the right reason? You have to know the time for doing these things. What you're talking about, is it purposeful? Does it help you on the path? Or does it hold you back in your practice? Yeah, so all of these things is about how things are able either to be helpful in our practice or they will hold us back. And this is very useful and very important, because if we challenge our senses too much, sometimes I hear people say, yeah, it's much better to be a layperson than to be a monastic, yeah, because if you're a layperson, you have much more challenges. Well, that's precisely the problem with being a lay. There's too many challenges. There's enough challenges already as a monastic, I can tell you. It's not that easy. Yeah, you just kind of chill out all the time and it's really easy. There's plenty of difficulties enough if you are a monastic. You don't really need all those challenges. If there are too many challenges, you can't deal with it. That's the problem. Your mind gets completely flooded by impressions and things. And it's impossible to hold back the defilements of the mind, whether it's aversion or sensual desire. Sometimes I hear this thing that, better be a lay person because you have more challenges. I think, I'm not so sure about that. You've got to think about that carefully before you say these kind of things. It is challenging enough as it is. You can bring, and regardless of that, you can bring these things into lay life as well. And remind yourself what the things that I do in my daily life, how I go about things, is it purposeful or is it a hindrance to my spiritual practice? And if you are serious about your spiritual practice, if you give priority to your spiritual life over everything else, and I would really recommend you to do that, put that on as the highest priority. Everything else should be secondary. Because after all, what is the purpose of life? If the purpose of life is found in anything, it is in developing yourself, developing your mind. Yeah, it's so obvious. Everything else is ephemeral. Everything else will fall away. Everything else will just, at latest when you die, will be gone. What is the real purpose? To develop our minds and hopefully even have some nice samadhi, some insights and all of these kind of things. So if you, once you get that this is really what it's all about, then you look at everything in your life as something that helps you in your spiritual practice. Yeah, your family life, your work, everything can be looked upon in that way. I know it's easy, much easier said than done, but it's a very valuable way of looking at life. At least you move a little bit in that direction. And then, of course, what happens is that everything turns out better. Your ordinary life turns out better as well, because once you imbue your ordinary life with the spiritual practice, basically means you are more kind and caring for the world around you. Of course, that's going to get good results as a consequence. So please, is it a beautiful way of looking at life? How do I live my life? Do I live it in such a way that I have clear comprehension whether this is purposeful and suitable and it actually leads somewhere in my practice? And this is a standard way of thinking about clear comprehension, sampajanya in the suttas. And you will see this is the way it is taught pretty much everywhere in the Buddhist world. So let's have a look at some of the details. I think most of the details are fairly obvious. There is, however, a couple of things in here that are not all that obvious. This is where it says at the bottom there, it says you have clear comprehension, you're acting with clear comprehension when you are walking, yeah, or going, standing, sitting, or lying down. Actually, the Pali does not say lying down. This is really a mistranslation, I have to say. The Pali word lying down is always a different word in the Pali. This word here is sutte, and sutte actually means sleeping. Yeah, and this is actually quite interesting, sleeping, because you may wonder how on earth can you have clear comprehension while you are sleeping. In walking, in sleeping, he has clear comprehension. In keeping awake, when you are awake, in speaking and staying silent. And this, I think, this little word here, which is generally translated wrong by almost all translators, for this reason, actually, very, how is it possible to have clear comprehension in sleeping? Yeah, or as other people translate, while, they don't actually say while asleep, they say while falling asleep. That's also another word in Pali. It doesn't mean while falling, it means actually while sleeping. Yeah. How? What's going on here? And this is one of those little things that I think give away what this whole paragraph actually is about. Usually it is said you have full comprehension in doing these things, while you are doing these things. And if that is how you translate this, it doesn't make any sense, because how can you have full comprehension while you are sleeping? When you're sleeping, you're out of it. That's kind of the definition of sleep. You don't know what's going on. The appropriate translation here, in my opinion, and this is to do that, you have to understand a little bit of Pali grammar. The Pali grammar here can be understood in different ways. And one way of understanding this particular word, sutta here, is in regard to sleeping. Yeah, you have clear comprehension in regard to sleeping. The case ending is called the locative case ending. Sutta, the E ending in Pali. And that can have different meanings depending on the context. And one of the meanings is in regard to sleeping. Venerable Sunya here, also expert in Pali, he can back me up if I need backing up. So, sutta, is that right, Venerable Sunya? Yeah. Okay, good. So he's actually the Pali teacher at our monastery right now, so that's pretty cool. So in regard to sleeping, and once you understand that one of the meanings is in regard to sleeping, it suddenly comes together very nicely. Yeah, you are acting with clear comprehension in regard to sleeping. In other words, you know the right amount of sleep. You know when to get up. You know when to get to bed, and that sort of thing. You have clear comprehension, or you act with clear full comprehension in regard to being awake. You know when to be awake, and etc., etc. Suddenly, it comes together very nicely, and you can see why sutta actually must mean the right understanding of it is the usual understanding of being asleep in regard to this. And then this whole paragraph, in a sense, comes out slightly differently. Yeah, it then becomes basically you act with clear comprehension in regard to all of these things. Because everything has to change if you change one of these words, because the structure is exactly the same for each sentence. So it becomes, he acts with clear comprehension in regard to going forward and going back. He acts with clear comprehension in looking forward and back. He acts with clear comprehension for all of these ones in regard to these things. So it's not necessarily the case that you are absolutely mindful with every little act that you do, but that you have an overall awareness of what you're doing things for, and you keep that overall awareness in the back of your mind as you do these things, so you can act with purpose and suitability. Suddenly, the whole passage kind of comes together very nicely, and this is how I think this should be understood. You can just push the door, I think, and it will open up. Or pull it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Okay. And so that is how I will understand this passage. And you may wonder, who am I to kind of say that this is how this passage is to be understood? If other people translate it differently, how do you know who is right in this particular situation? Yeah. How do you actually tell these things? And this is one of the reasons why I started off by talking about the Satipatthana Sutta. And I said that this particular passage that we're reading now is actually included in the Satipatthana Sutta, although here the Buddha says it is separate from Satipatthana. Which one is right? What is going on here? And I think the problem is precisely because the fact that it is included in the Satipatthana Sutta has made people believe that this is about being aware moment to moment. Yeah, because that's what Satipatthana is about. It's about being aware moment to moment. You're aware of the breath where you are, you know, you have a continuous mindfulness about things. So once you include it there, then that will have affected how these things are translated. But actually, you see, it doesn't really make any sense, because you cannot have moment to moment awareness while you are sleeping here. Yeah, so this is kind of the problem here. For that reason, I think that is the kind of the historical background to that. It's very strange, it's interesting. Once the suttas change a little bit, it has these kind of effects, yeah? It affects the suttas in a broader sense, and you start to read them in a different and a new way. And it affects the passages of this one, how you translate it, precisely because you are used to it being part of the Satipatthana Sutta, so you translate it in accordance with that, even though originally it may not have been part of that sutta at all. So you can see how little changes on that. It looks so innocuous. Yeah, of course. Yeah, Sampajanya formula, you place it into the Satipatthana Sutta, because obviously this is about Satipatthana. It's called Sati Sampajanya in many places. And then it has this kind of cascading effect, and it starts to affect other passages as well. And you get a different view. You start to get slowly a different view of what is going on. That is, I think, the reasoning, and that is my reasoning anyway, for looking at this passage in this particular way. And I think there are good grounds for it, from a kind of textual point of view. It's not just, I try to avoid just making up random stuff. So I think there is some good grounds for that. I do apologize if I go into too much detail. I always feel a bit sorry when someone is leaving. Like, oh, I didn't know this was going to be about this. this is too heavy going. I can understand. If the first time you come to a sutta class and you have to listen to this, you probably wonder, wow, these suttas, I'm never going to get into that, that's for sure. So that's a bit unfortunate. Anyway, but many of you have been around for a long time, so I hope you kind of enjoy this a little bit. So that is a clear comprehension. Basically coming back to the idea of purposefulness and suitability. It's a very useful thing to integrate into your life and see what actually is conducive to the practice. What makes you more kind? Yeah? What makes you have less defilements in the mind and all these kind of things. And then you start to, things start to work better, hopefully, here. Okay, so that is that passage. Everybody happy with that? Okay, so if everyone's happy, then we can move on, I suppose. So now we have kind of the monks have been pre-warned that this very beautiful courtesan Ambapali, she is about to arrive. And actually, the sequence here is not so clear, but there is a slightly different sequence in one of the parallel versions of the sutta, where they kind of hear about the Ambapali coming first of all, and then this passage on clear comprehension comes after that. In the Pali, it's not so obvious, the connection. One of the really nice things I should point out is that if you Ambapali, she later on becomes a nun, and she has some very nice verses in the Terigata, the verses of the elder nuns. And the verses, and they're very kind of powerful verses. And because she was so beautiful, she kind of looks at the deterioration of her body as she gets older. And then she eventually ends up becoming an arahant. And very kind of powerful, those verses by Ambapali in the Terigata. So if you want to check those out, they should be available. I think they may be available on Sutta Central at least. I think so. I'm not 100% sure. But anyway. Okay, so this is what happens next. Now Ambapali, the courtesan, heard that the Lord had arrived at Vesali and was staying at her mango grove. She had the best carriages made ready and drove from Vesali to her park. She drove as far as the ground would allow, then alighted and went on foot to where the Lord was. She saluted the Lord and sat down to one side. As she sat, the Lord instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted her with a talk on Dhamma. And being thus delighted, Ambapali said, Lord, may the Lord consent to take a meal from me tomorrow with his order of monks. The Lord consented by silence, and Ambapali, understanding his acceptance, rose from her seat, saluted the Lord, and passing him to the right, departed. So here is Ambapali's short visit to the Buddha. There's more about her later on, but this is kind of the short starting point. And you hear that the Buddha has arrived in her mango, and she's obviously, what happens is that you are very happy, if someone like the Buddha is staying in your mango, you get so happy because of that. So straight away she goes out to see him, and she wants to invite him to a meal. This is usually how people feel delighted when these things happen. It's a bit like people, inviting Ajahn Brahm to their house and saying, oh, please come and have a meal in my house, similar kind of thing. But maybe, probably much more powerful than that. So she had all her best carriages made ready. So again, she was a wealthy, very wealthy woman. And she drove out from Vesali to her park. So she was obviously quite independent. She wasn't married or anything like that. So that was kind of a unique situation in India in those days. And then you have this kind of standard phrase that you find in the suttas. She drove as far as the ground would allow, and then alighted and went on foot to where the Lord was. So this idea here, first of all, she is wealthy, and one of the things that you see in the suttas, and I think one of the points of this is to point out that the wealthy people too were Buddhist. Buddhism was a religion or a teaching for everyone, and a lot of the patrons of Buddhism were very wealthy people. A lot of the monks and nuns came from wealthy, high-class backgrounds. And the reason was because the Dhamma was so powerful that it drew you in. And this is one of the points that you often found made in the suttas in this particular way. So she goes as far as she can in her carriages, then she gets down and she walks on foot to the Buddha. What is that all about? Why are these things in there? One of the things about the suttas is that usually things have a purpose. Things are not in there for kind of just because of some random error or whatever. Sometimes that is true, but usually they have a purpose. And I think the purpose of this here is this idea that the Buddha is always staying some distance away from roads, some distance away from civilization. So you, and this gives an idea what the monasteries were like in those days, and it gives an idea how to prepare monasteries in the present day. Yeah, how to establish monasteries in the right way. So the monastery is not exactly where the road was, so the road comes to a halt, and then you have to walk the last bit to be able to meet the Buddha. It was secluded, it was away from things. So this is kind of the ideal way of establishing a monastery here. So when you think about that, you kind of think, well, what about Bodhinyana Monastery here? There's a road going all the way in, people drive all the way here. Maybe what we should do is kind of stop at the gate, have a car park there, and then people have to walk down, like a little path instead. Yeah, maybe not. I know it's not necessary, but you know, this is how it was done in those days. And then we can tear up the bitumen, we can do something else there. But I think the situation is in many ways quite parallel, because even at Bodhinyana Monastery, to really go to the kutis, where the monks live, you always have to go through the forest, first of all, to actually get there. But it's a nice way of thinking about monastery. This gives you an idea what the ideal monastery was like in those days. So it is kind of a good precedent for how to develop our Buddhist community now, in the monastic community in particular here. And then it says that she walks, she saluted him, which means really to bow down, yeah? And then, as always happens, then the Buddha instructs her, inspires, fires, and delights her with a talk on the Dhamma. And this is kind of one of the ideas of a Dhamma talk. If it is well delivered, it should inspire you. You should feel like practicing the Buddhist teachings once you are finished. This is the purpose of the Dhamma talk, one of the purposes of Dhamma talks. It is not just to pass across information. Of course, some degree of information is required, but in the end, once you know enough about the Dhamma, really, the main reason why you want to hear a Dhamma talk is to keep you inspired, to remind you of the importance of this, to remind you this is actually the very meaning of life itself. This is what really matters. Everything else is irrelevant by comparison. And when you get that and you kind of take it on board, it's like you are attuning to right view, if you like. That is when you really want to practice this path. So this is one of the purposes of the main purpose of the Buddha, is to inspire people. And this is what you see this throughout the suttas all the time. Not just an information transfer. And then when she is inspired, then she feels really inspired, and then she invites him to a meal for the next day. And of course that is what happens in the present day as well. People call up the monastery and they say, Ajahn Brahm, please come to our house. Ajahn says, sorry, too busy. Please, please, please come to our house. Sorry, too busy. Please. And then sometimes I have to go. Sometimes Ajahn Appi has to go. Someone else has to go instead. So this is sometimes what happens. But it's so this is an ancient tradition going back to the time of the Buddha, that you get invited to people's houses and you have your meal at the house. And one of the reasons for that is because it is easy to give a little bit of a Dhamma talk in a house. If you go on alms round, there's not much chance to actually teach Dhamma. But if you go to someone's house, then the Buddha will always give the Anumodana after the meal. So he eats his meal and afterwards he gives the Anumodana. The Anumodana is like the rejoicing, yeah? Anumodana literally means something like rejoicing. And the way the Buddha would do that, he would always give a little Dhamma teaching. You know, the power of generosity, or the power of virtue, or something about meditation and practice, or something like that. This is what he would do when he went to a house. I think often very short teachings. They would maybe last only 5 minutes or so. If you look at the suttas we have now, they're often very short and they're very succinct, dealing with one very specific matter, like generosity or virtue or something like that. But of course, in the present day, if you go to the monastery, that's Anumodana has become like a chant in the Pali language, was exactly the same day after day. That's why we do it in Pali, because if you understood it, you would be bored out of your brains. It's the same thing every day. So we keep it in Pali so that you are suitably kind of obfuscated what actually we're talking about. It's not that inspiring anyway here. Some of it is quite nice, but some of it is really uninspiring, to be honest. That's why we keep it in Pali, so that nobody really, really gets it. We don't have to feel embarrassed by what we chant. Yes, sir. Please, yeah. No, this is my point. The Buddha would give a Dhamma talk, yeah? And this is what is so interesting. So he would say different things every time he went to a monastery or went to a house. He would give a little Dhamma talk about dana, a little bit about this, about that. And then over the centuries, and this is what is so interesting, over the centuries, this, what used to be a very beautiful thing of giving a proper Dhamma teaching, somehow it gets kind of forced into a straitjacket and becomes one teaching that is exactly the same every time and kept in the Pali language. It's very much easier if you're a monk, if you have to give the same teaching every time, you all have to chant the same thing. So you can see why these things happen. And then you imbue it with a bit of magic. Yeah, so this is powerful stuff for chanting. Okay, now we're going to give it a bit of magic. So then it kind of becomes it. At the time of the Buddha, it was a Dhamma talk, short Dhamma talk. So, and this is one of the nice things. If you go to Dhammasara Monastery, do you go to Dhammasara Hutong? Yeah, yeah. If you go there, Venerable Hasapanya will give often a little bit of a Dhamma talk after the meal. Yeah, yeah. So she's actually following closer to what the Buddha did than sometimes we find in our monastery here. So, which is kind of nice, yeah. So, anyway, this has become the standard. Of course, these things kind of happen gradually over time, yeah. And after a while, people get used to it. They expect to hear that chanting, and if they don't hear the chanting, they get really disappointed. Yeah, they want to hear the chanting. What happened to the chanting? We don't want to just hear a Dhamma talk. We want to hear the chanting, please. We want to have the chanting back. Yeah? So after a while, we kind of get stuck in that routine because it's kind of expected. Huh? So this is how things often kind of, over the centuries change. And there's so much of that in Buddhism, this problem of things getting ritualized and formalized in certain ways. There's a lot of that happening in the Buddhist teachings. Yeah, you have these things in monasteries, you have like things like a lot of things being done in Pali. Chanting suttas, for example, or even chanting the Patimokkha. Nobody has a clue what is going on, but this is the way we do it. We do it in Pali. The fact that the Buddha said you should do it in English, that's kind of irrelevant, because Pali, that's the tradition, that's where we've always done things. So this is the problem, and you see it in so many areas of Buddhism, where things become ritualized and formalized in a certain way. It loses its original purpose, and it becomes kind of, you get this new purpose, which is completely different from what it was originally.
I'll
repeat it. How late is the Anumodana formulated? If you look, I don't know, to be honest. We have no idea when this was started. But if you look at the general chanting, that the Pirit chanting, Paritta chanting, called Pirit in the Sinhala and Paritta in Pali, there is a large variety. Some of the Parittas are based on suttas, and they're almost exactly the same as the suttas. Some Parittas were kind of invented in the Middle Ages. Some Parittas are entirely modern. They were kind of invented about a century or two ago. They were written down by some king of Thailand or something like that. So there's a whole variety. And I think the Anumodana are probably the same. There are parts of the Anumodana that are very ancient. Parts of the Anumodana we do actually is, one of it is a verse from the Dhammapada, for example. That's obviously very ancient. When it became part of the Anumodana, I don't know, but at least that part of it is ancient. And then things have been added over time and expanded. So there isn't any clear kind of cut-off point as such with these things. Anyway, so that is what is happening. And so you can see here, it's always fascinating. When I read the suttas, it's so many of the things that we do in the modern world as Buddhists, actually they have their basis in the suttas. There's so much of it, and you see it actually all everywhere, all the way through. The Lord consented by his silence. We don't do that anymore. These days we, on the phone, if we stay silent, people wonder what's going on. We usually say yes, we will come. But that was the way things were done often in those days. If you, for example, in the Sangha, you have a Sangha meeting, and then if you are opposed to a certain motion or a certain proposal in the Sangha, you have to voice your proposal. If you remain silent, it is assumed that you accept the proposal. So silence is considered like an acceptance. You have to voice it if you want to be against something. Okay, and then she saluted the Lord. In other words, she bowed down to the Buddha, passing him by the right. This means she circumambulated him with her right side towards him. Yeah, this is the ancient traditional way of doing things. That's why we have the right shoulder uncovered. The reason is because it's a way of kind of showing respect that you don't have your right shoulder covered. So that's why the right shoulder is uncovered, and then you circumambulate the person with the right shoulder towards them. This is the ancient Indian tradition. Okay, so then it continues in the following way. And the Lichavis of Vaisali heard that the Lord had arrived at Vaisali and was staying in Ambapali's grove. So they too had the best carriages made ready and drove out of Vaisali. And some of the young Lichavis were all in blue, with blue makeup, blue clothes, blue adornment. Well, some were in yellow, some were in red, some in white, with white makeup, white clothes, and white adornment. So the Lichavis of Vaisali, these were the aristocrats of Vaisali. They were the leading clan who kind of were very wealthy and powerful in Vaisali. And you can see the way they are described is obviously a way of describing someone who powerful. They had all these carriages, yeah, and they kind of dress up as if they're going to a fancy dress party or something. Yeah, and they're actually going to see the Buddha. And so they drive out from Vaisali. So these are very powerful people. These are the top aristocrats who actually pretty much ran this whole republic, or the Vajjan Republic. Yeah. So what happens next is quite interesting. Yeah. And Ambapali met the young Lichavis, axle to axle, wheel to wheel, yoke to yoke. So she was driving away from the Buddha, and they were coming towards the Buddha, yeah? And they said to her, Ambapali, why do you drive up against us like that? Because, young sirs, the Blessed Lord has been invited by me for the meal with his order of monks. Yeah. And so she is like kind of almost like teasing them a little bit, yeah, because I think she probably realizes why they're going there, and now she's kind of saying, da 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 da, I got the Buddha, something to that effect. And so the Pali here, actually, the way the Pali is phrased, see, patti vatesi, she turns around. Yes, you can imagine they're kind of meeting each other on the road as they are kind of approaching the Buddha from different directions, or she is going away, they are approaching him. And then as she's approaching, she turns around, yeah? And then she drives up, wheel to wheel, axle to axle, all the way up to them. And then she shouts to them, yeah? Or something like that. But remember that she is a courtesan. As a courtesan, you are not as high up as the aristocracy. She's obviously very successful, or very wealthy and all these things, but still, she is. These are the real aristocrats. So she's kind of taking a bit of a risk here by behaving in a fairly kind of very kind of direct manner, if you like. Then the Lichavis, they say, Ambapali, give up this meal for 100,000 coins, kahapanas. Young sirs, if you were to give me all of Vaisali with all of its revenue, I would not give up such an important meal. Then the Lichavis snapped their fingers, saying, we've been beaten by the mango woman. We've been cheated by the mango woman. Yeah, and they set out for Ambapali's grove. Ambapali, her name, Amba means mango in Pali, and Pali means like the guardian of the mangoes. And that's why they call her the mango woman, yeah? Because that was basically what she was, her name pretty much means. So it's a nice little exchange there, and you can see here how she treats this idea of supporting the Buddha as a very, very important thing, yeah? And this is how people would have seen it probably in those days. Giving up all of Vaisali with this revenue. Revenue is ahara. Ahara means like nutriment or food. So it probably refers to all the fields and all the orchards, everything that is there to support Vesali. Would have been a very large area to support a fairly large city. Yeah. So she's kind of really setting the price very high. And still, she doesn't want to give it away here. So it's a nice little kind of interlude in the story here. But then comes what happens when the Lichavis then go and see the Buddha. And the Lord, having seen the Lichavis from afar, said, "Monks, any of you who have not seen the 33 gods, Tavatinsa Devas, just look at the troop of Lichavis, take a good look at them, and you will get an idea of the 33 gods." That's an interesting little thing here. And I always wondered, why? What exactly is this about? I've never been entirely clear to me. I think one of the points is to kind of point out that the Lichavis are very powerful. Yeah, if they are like the gods, it means like they're kind of almost like a kind of semi-deities almost in their wealth and in their kind of in the way they look and all of these kind of things. That may be part of it. Another part of it may perhaps be that the Buddha is saying, well, you know, there are such deities in this world. You may not have seen them. Yeah, you may not know what they are like. They can be seen if you develop your mind enough. But there are such beings in this universe. And if you have never seen them before, well, this is perhaps the closest that you will get. So check it out. This is what the gods do all day. Yeah, they run around in chariots and they kind of amuse themselves clad in blue, red and yellow. And I don't know, does that sound interesting? Not entirely sure, but I think in those days, probably that was what how people imagined, you know, being wealthy and all these kind of things. So I'm not entirely clear what this passage means, but something like that, probably. Do you have any ideas, Elmo Senior?
No.
Yeah? Same? Yeah, roughly same? Okay.
So. I haven't thought about it actually, I just read it.
Yeah. Sometimes you don't think about these things until you kind of, yeah, that's true. Huh? Okay. So that is that little interlude there. And then, of course, one of the important points here as well is that you will notice that it was actually not very common for the monks to know about these deities. Otherwise, they wouldn't have to say this. Sometimes people say, oh, you know, in those days, you know, there were deities left, right, and center. How come there are no deities these days? What's going on? But this actually points out, actually, there wasn't as if there were deities everywhere. You had to develop your mind very in deep states of samadhi before you could actually be able to see these kind of things. That hasn't really changed. That's true today as well. And I know monks who do this kind of thing and who tell me that, you know, they have seen this kind of stuff, which is kind of fascinating. So whether you kind of, I don't know if you, what do you think about that, but that's what I have, what I understand. Yes, please. We're talking. Yeah. 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 I think it's. Yeah. Sure. I think it's probably meant as a mental thing here. Yeah, that's what I would interpret it as that. I don't think, for you personally, that's what it feels like because you're kind of perceiving it in your mind. I don't think it is physically getting lit. Or maybe it is. I'm not sure. But I'm a little bit skeptical about that, to be honest with you. Makes more sense, yeah. 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 It should be, exactly. And if you look at where it is, you know, where it is phrased, it's always in the kind of narrative part as well. So it is not, you know, it's something that has been added to the sutta later usually. Kind of the narrative, I don't think the Buddha ever says anywhere, oh, the gods came down, everything was kind of bright. Actually, you'd have to research that in more kind of precision. But that's, I think, generally true anyway. Okay, then the Lichavis drove in their carriages as far as the ground would allow. Then they alighted and went on foot to where the Lord was, saluted him and sat down to one side. And as they sat, the Lord instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted them with a talk on Dhamma. And being thus delighted, they said, "Lord, may the Lord consent to take a meal from us tomorrow with his order of monks. But Lichavis, I have already accepted a meal for tomorrow from the courtesan Ambapali. And the Lichavis snapped their fingers, saying, we've been beaten by the mango woman, we've been cheated by the mango woman. Then, having rejoiced and delighted in his talk, they rose from the seat, saluted the Lord, and passing him by on the right, departed. And just that little passage is also quite nice, and it says a little bit about how the Buddha does things and what is the right way of, dealing with people, especially if you are a member of the Sangha. It would have been very easy for the Buddha to say that the Lichavis are much more important than Ambapali. These are the people in power. These are the people who are wealthy. You know, for this, they are really would be very useful to have a good connection with them for the Sangha in the future. And then kind of find an excuse and say, well, sorry, Ambapali, what about, you know, can we come to your house another day or something like that? But he doesn't do that. For the Buddha, it is a... I think he probably realizes that Ambapali is far more ready to hear the Dhamma than the Lichavis. Lichavis are far more attached to the sensuality, etc. Whereas Ambapali is already, a woman who is very close to ordaining. She's about to give away the mango grove to the Sangha, and she has very powerful spiritual qualities. And one of the things is that for a Buddha, it is much more interesting to teach somebody who has strong spiritual faculties than somebody who is just kind of, hanging out in lay love and waiting for a nice rebirth or something like that. So here, he prefers teaching Ambapali. The obvious other reason is simply that she was first, yeah? And there is that integrity. If someone comes first, then that is the person you go to. And that is, how you do things. And that, I think, is a very important thing to remember also in the modern world. It is always so easy to get sidetracked by all of these worldly things, yeah? Who is more important? Who is kind of where? Instead of having that integrity to remember to do things, not just according to worldly standards, but according to what is right from a Dhamma perspective. The person who asks first, that is where you go first, regardless of who they are. I think that... that thing is actually very important, especially in the world today where often there is so much support for the Sangha. Yeah, there's so much support, there's so much wealth, and so much things going on. And it's very easy to kind of be led down that worldly alley and the worldly, in the worldly ways, and then actually forget about what really matters on the Buddhist path. So it's a nice little reminder, I'm always like Ajahn Brahm for that, because he also has a lot of integrity in that area, in that he doesn't really favor people because of any worldly status or any worldly situation. He tries to treat people pretty much exactly the same. Yeah, the same in the monastery. He treats all the monks exactly the same. Ajahn Brahm is not someone you can kind of bribe or you can kind of have a special relationship. Nobody has a special relationship with Ajahn Brahm, unless perhaps that, if you are in a position on the committee, okay, you get to talk to him more often simply because of the position. But you don't have any kind of preferential treatment in terms of, whatever. I have seen that over a long period of time, and for those people who want to have special relationships, they always get frustrated by hanging around with Ajahn Brahm. It's not going to happen with Ajahn Brahm. He just doesn't do that sort of thing. There's this evenness of treating people. And that is really nice, actually, and it's very liberating, very freeing. Everybody feels that they are treated in the same way. It's actually a very positive thing in the long run. Okay, so maybe I should just do the next paragraph, because that will kind of, I think, round off. So I hope you don't mind. If you don't have to go, please feel free to go at any time, because I know that sometimes I tend to carry on a little bit. But if we don't do another paragraph, then we'll be adding probably another year to finishing the sutta, so we better do another paragraph. And Ambapali, when the night was nearly over, having had choice, hard and soft food prepared at her home, announced to the Lord that the meal was ready. Having dressed and taken his robe and bowl, the Lord went with the order of monks to Ambapali's residence and sat down on the prepared seat. And she served the Buddha and his monks with choice, hard and soft food till they were satisfied. And when the Lord had taken his hand from the bowl, Ambapali took a low stool and sat down to one side. So here you have this funny thing, hard and soft food, and nobody really knows exactly what it refers to. It refers to two different types of food, bhojaniya and khadaniya in Pali. And it can possibly means either staple and non-staple food, and possibly means cooked food and uncooked food. Those are the two possible versions that I've seen of the meaning of these things. Hard and soft doesn't really make much sense to me. But cooked and uncooked is a translation I like quite well. So in other words, the point is just that he prepares all this choice. In other words, a sublime, nice food. Yeah, it's panita. Panita means like delightful, sublime food that she prepares. And this is one of those aspects again. If you want to support the Buddha, and whenever you want to do an act of generosity in general, if you do it with good things, yeah, if you use good ingredients and you do something which is well done, it is considered a much better kind of generosity than it is otherwise. And you tend to feel more, has a more powerful effect also in your meditation and later on in your life if you do things in this way. Yeah. So this is actually the point of these little point things here, is to point also to how generosity is done in the right way. Yeah, you do things with in a good way in this sense. And then they have the meal, yeah, and then she takes a low stool. And again, this is what you see here, exactly what happens in today. When you are a monk, you kind of sit on the on the stage, yeah. This is exactly, comes directly again from the suttas, the idea that, you know, depending on your kind of seniority within the system almost, the monks would often have kind of sit on a slightly higher stage. So this again, directly from the sutta. This would travel around the Buddhist world. You see this everywhere. Everywhere it is like this. Wherever you go, it's exactly what you find. And then what happens next is that, so seated, Ambapali said, "Lord, I give this park to the order of monks with a Buddha at its head." The Lord accepted the park, and then he instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted her with a talk on Dhamma, after which he rose from his seat and departed. And actually, one thing I didn't say there, there's one thing missing in there. She also gives the food, not only does she give the food, but she gives it with her own hands. Sahata. The word hasn't been translated from the Pali. Yeah, this is something of the danger of getting the English. You're never 100% sure. Sahata, you give with your own hands. And this is another factor in whether giving and generosity has been kind of done to the highest degree, is whether you do it yourself or you kind of send a servant to do it. Yeah, you send some servant. Okay, yeah, you feed those monks. Yeah, I haven't got time for that. So that's kind of a difference. So we don't find that very often, I'm honest. We don't get all the servants showing up with food. It's quite uncommon. So people usually serve with their own hand. And there's something powerful about that. I'm sure you know what I mean. When you do it with your own hand, it feels much more as if you're fully being generous, yeah? Like you are doing it yourself. If you send a servant, of course, it's still good karma. It doesn't have the same power. I'm sure you can relate to that. I certainly can relate to that very quite easily. And then when she gives, then she gives her park, yeah? She's obviously kind of winding up her affairs, and now she's so inspired by the Buddha staying in her park that she gives the park. And when she gives it to the order of monks. And this is one of those things, again, about how to give something. When you give something, you do with a broad mind, yeah? You try not to give just to an individual or to one person, but you give with this idea of, I give it to the whole Sangha, both male and female, ideally, both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and often both present and also yet to come, also the future Sangha as well, and the whole Sangha, yeah, everyone who's part of this worldwide movement of Buddhism. It's a very powerful thing when you think like that, because it means that this Ambapali's park was probably used by perhaps thousands of monks. Yeah, many generations after she passed away, it would have been used in this way. And when you think about that, and you think that many of those monks may have achieved deep states of samadhi, they may have become enlightened in her park, and of course that gives rise to tremendous joy when you do this kind of things. So when you give, broaden out your mind. Think that I'm giving here You know, even when you come and offer some food to the monastery, think, I'm doing this to support not just this monastery, this monk, but I'm doing this to support Buddhism worldwide. How can you think like that? Well, it's not that hard, because if you support one sangha or one community, they give teachings. Those teachings are then spread out on the internet or whatever it is. Millions of people listen to these teachings. And because you are supporting that, you are supporting that whole process of making the Dhamma available in the world. And once you kind of start to get that, it becomes very beautiful and very powerful, and something that can give rise to a lot of joy in your meditation practice. So giving itself is an art. It is not something that is just, you just give, and kind of, you know, sometimes people, you know, you see these little kids who want to give, and they kind of, they're a little bit shy, so they kind of just whack something on the stage and they walk off quickly, That is kind of not the ideal way of giving. But because you're a little kid, it's okay, but that's kind of the, not the best way, So this gives you some, lots of little pointers here in how, you know, generosity is done in the right way. And then of course, again, you have this idea of the Buddha then giving the instruction again afterwards. And then while staying at Vesali, the Lord delivered not a comprehensive, he gave many discourses to the monks. This is morality, this is samadhi, stillness, this is wisdom. And this, again, just to remind you, this little teaching is like a refrain that you see throughout the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Yeah, again and again and again, the Buddha teaches this. Morality, then samadhi, then wisdom coming as a consequence of that. Why does he do it again and again? Well, obviously, to drive home that this is one of the ways that summarizes his teachings very powfully here. And then that whole paragraph, very beautiful, it says that when the samadhi is imbued with sila, it is of great fruit, great benefit. When the wisdom is imbued with samadhi, it is of great fruit, great benefit. And this tells you so much about how the path works. If the samadhi isn't good enough yet, what do I need to do on the side of sila and virtue? If the panya isn't deep enough, how can I get my samadhi deeper? That is what this tells you, basically. Anyway, I'm going to stop there, because now we have just finished a section on Vesali and on the mango grove. So this nice, inspiring thing. Is there anything else that we should, anyone would like to bring up? Thank you very much. Okay, we've got a couple of questions here. Oh, okay. Does anyone have anything they want to say, mention? Yeah. Peter. Oh, that's the Mahasudassana Sutta. He died there 8 times. Yeah, maybe not. I mean, it's kind of weird, because Kushinara was a small little town in India a long time ago. And why would that have existed kind of infinitely into the past? It sounds kind of weird. I think that the reason why that is in there is just to make Kusinara sound more important. Remember, one of the interesting things about, we come to this later on in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where Ananda says to the Buddha, why are you dying here? Yeah, this kind of backwater, this kind of beyond the black stump, you know, way in the outback somewhere. There's nothing here except for a few kangaroos and bobtails, you know, that's all there is. What on earth? Why do you want to die here? There's all these great cities, isn't it? That's where you should pass away. That's kind of suitable for a Buddha. And then, based on that, the Buddha then tells this magnificent story called the Mahasudassana Sutta, which is a massive legend, really. And towards the end of that sutta, he says, well, I've died here 7 times before, The whole thing sounds like it is a kind of way of boosting Kushinara's status to make it worthy of a Buddha. And that's the kind of thing that happens after the Buddha passes away. Everybody wants to kind of boost up the Buddha. How can the Buddha pass away in Kushinara? It's impossible. Okay, this is the reason. Now we understand why he passed away there, Yeah, something like that. Anyone else? Everyone else happy? Yeah? Okay. No? Okay. Complaints? No complaints either? Okay. Very good. Okay, so let's see what they have from overseas. This is from Jan Erik from Norway. Okay, hello Jan Erik. Nice to hear from you. So, a fellow Norwegian. So, it's rare to hear from fellow Norwegians. That's really cool. So this is what he has to say. If we have gone through countless rebirths for eons, Why are we still so ignorant of truth, still shocked when old age and death happens to us? This is the problem. Yeah, this is the problem I was just talking about, the idea of delusion on Friday. Yeah? And that delusion tends to be self-perpetuating. Yeah? And delusion actually depends on the strength of the hindrances. And because the hindrances are always there and delusion is always there, it really... we don't really learn anything, and this is kind of the scary thing about samsara. You look into your past lives, and you said you've been doing exactly the same silly mistakes, life after life, again and again. You don't really learn from life to life, and part of the reason you don't learn is because you can't remember. Yeah, you don't know what happened, so you've got no memory of these things, and because of that, it doesn't really happen. So, and this is kind of the scary thing about this. You don't actually learn all that much. And this is why, when you have the opportunity, it is so important to take that opportunity, because now you have the chance. Of course, if you learn something in this life, the more you learn in this life, you will take some of that with you into your next life. But then whatever happens in your next life then may kind of drag you down again. You may lose that wisdom in your next life because you'll be influenced by some other religion or no religion at all or whatever. So you lose that wisdom you had in this life. Yes, it really depends on the circumstances you are born. Remember, everyone is really, we are the product of our circumstances and conditions. So when the conditions, circumstances are such that we lose wisdom, well, that's what we do. When the supporting conditions are such that we increase in wisdom, we increase in wisdom. But it's always like this roller coaster ride. And this is the problem with samsaric existence. That's a very good point. And keep that in mind. And if you keep that in mind, it will make this life far more meaningful and far more significant, because it means now you really have the opportunity to do something. And then, so you don't lose it all again in the future, perhaps. This is from, I think this must be from Wayin in Malaysia. Hello, Wayin. I just met you a couple of weeks ago when I was in Malaysia. That's really nice to hear from you again. I heard layperson is very difficult, impossible to attain enlightenment due to daily distractions. What do you think? Did the Buddha say anything about it? What the Buddha says is that he lays down the monastic life because it is the ideal vehicle for practicing the path. Yeah. So if you are a monastic, it's not just about being a monastic, it also is about how you are a monastic. You actually have to practice. You have to have an interest in these things. But if you do the practice well and fully, then the monastic path is preferable. I think quite a lot preferable, actually, to living lay life, because you have very good supporting circumstances, usually, except when you have arguments in the Buddhist side and that sort of stuff, but usually you have very good supporting circumstances. So I'm being naughty, I apologize. And that is why in lay life it's so much more easy to be distracted, so much easier to forget about the Dhamma. When you're in the monastery, you're around monks all the time. Yeah, you're kind of always surrounded by Dhamma. And as you go back to your kuti, I spend hours and hours and hours every day just by myself in my kuti, and all you have around me is like Dhamma stuff, the walking path. It's like you're constantly reminded of what you're doing. So it is a much better way of living. It is not impossible to attain awakening as a layperson, but I think it is very difficult. I have to be honest about it. I think it is very hard, and it takes quite an exceptional practitioner to be able to attain stream entry even in this life, because you have to get that samadhi first of all. How many people actually get really deep samadhi? Yeah, it's not that many. Some people get that. And then you have to keep on practicing that samadhi for a while to be able to get the insight. A lot of things have to come together. If you are very committed, you practice really hard, you go to meditation centers quite regularly, your meditation is going well, you have the integrity to get everything right, there is some chance you might make this breakthrough yourself, even as a layperson. But if you are keen on monastic life and you think that is the right thing, I will definitely recommend it. But make sure you choose your monastery very carefully, because monasteries are so different. You want to go to a good place. You want to go to a place where you feel that you are thriving. Yeah, that makes sense to you. If you don't feel that, then sometimes you might as well stay as a layperson. Okay. Everybody, anything else? Everyone okay? Okay, let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.